I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And we start today with a decision in Europe that could reignite the debate over trying terrorism suspects in courtrooms here in the U.S. The European Court of Human Rights is giving the green light to the extradition of the radical cleric Abu Hamza al-Masri and several other men from London to the U.S., where they could be held in a Colorado prison and face terrorism charges. How would that work? Republicans blasted the Obama administration plans to try self-described 9/11 mastermind Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and other detainees at Guantanamo Bay in U.S. civilian courts. So what does today's decision mean? The BBC's political and security correspondent Rob Watson joins us from London. And Rob, you were telling us off-air that this decision that these men can be extradited has sort of reduced some of the excitement over this case in London.
And I suspect in the United States too. Well, it would have been an absolutely explosive decision on both sides of the Atlantic if the European Court of Human Rights had said they can't be extradited. Why do I say that? Well, essentially, it would have amounted to a judgment from the European Court of Human Rights saying supermax jails in the United States just aren't up to snuff in terms of the European standards on human rights. Now, that would have had all sorts of implications. It would have meant not just here in Britain, but other European countries would find it difficult to extradite terrorism suspects to the United States, and the United States would have seen itself judged very harshly by a European court. What they were saying was that the kind of conditions that you would find in a supermax prison in the United States if you were given a life sentence, no chance of parole, would have amounted to a violation of European human rights standards and that it would have been inhumane.
Yeah.
Now, that the court has decided that is simply not the case, and that while the potential sentences are very harsh, they would be proportionate to the kind of crimes that these people are accused of having committed.
Well, and it's assumed that they will be likely detained at the supermax prison in Colorado, held in solitary confinement there. Remind us of the charges against them.
There are six individuals. As you say, the most prominent, I suppose, is Abu Hamza. He's renowned in this country for his fiery sermons and his hook hand, and essentially he's facing two charges of being involved in allegedly involved in the kidnapping of tourists in the Yemen and of also trying to set up a terrorism training camp in the United States, and one of the other defendants is also accused of that. Two of the others are accused of being involved in the East Africa U.S. Embassy bombings in 1998, and the last two are essentially accused of inciting, supporting terrorism via the internet.
Yeah, and when you say the more prominent of the group, Abu Hamza al-Masri, who, by the way, is also blind in one eye with a hook on one hand. When you say he was accused of instigating terrorism in the U.S., he was accused of attempting to set up a terrorist training camp in Oregon. So what happens now? If they do come to the U.S. and are in solitary confinement in Colorado, is it assumed they'll have a trial?
Absolutely. I don't think there's any doubt about that. Otherwise, the European Court of Human Rights wouldn't have said it was okay for them to be extradited. No, I don't think that's in doubt. Of course, they're not on their way just yet. The court did say that they can exhaust all of their appeals, although it doesn't seem as though there's much of an avenue for that. So sometime in the next few months, at least five of the six men who'd launched this appeal should be on their way to the United States.
And do we understand there's one more court, I believe in France, that has to sign off on the extradition?
No, what it is that this ruling today comes from the European Court of Human Rights, but it has something called the Grand Chamber, which I guess is a special part of the court, and that is a place where you can ultimately appeal to. But historically, there have been very few cases that have ever got there, and those cases that have got there have by and large been turned away.
But you are familiar with the arguments here in the U.S. about the potential danger of putting high-profile terrorists on trial, that it could attract terrorism to the place where the trial is held. So do you have thoughts about what might happen going forward?
Well, I certainly am aware, and there's already a little bit of chatter on the internet about that I've seen some Americans saying, well, why on earth is Europe dumping these people on us? It's not quite like the whole Guantanamo setup, though. I mean, these people have all were originally indicted in the United States as far back, some of them as 1999 through to 2006. So these people have been indicted in the normal way. They haven't been captured on the battlefield, as some would have it. So I suspect there's going to be a lot less controversy about these five or six, depending on whether the sixth is extradited as well, as you've seen in some other of those cases that you're hinting at there.
The BBC's political and security correspondent, Rob Watson, in London. Rob, thanks so much.
Good to be with you.
And by the way, in a related story, Al-Qaeda warned Britain today not to deport another cleric who's considered to be a leading Al-Qaeda figure. Britain wants to expel Abu Qatada to Jordan. He spent 6 years in jail in Britain without being charged before he was released on bail last month. Qatada was convicted in absentia of terrorist offenses in Jordan, but that European Court of Human Rights we just spoke of ruled he can't be sent to Jordan because, as opposed to the thinking about the U.S. courts we just heard about, the European Court determined that evidence obtained through torture could be used against Qatada in a trial in Jordan. At a time when we hear talk of war between the U.S. and Iran, there's also talk of future mountain climbing expeditions. Let's explain. A group called the American Alpine Club has been practicing a form of grassroots mountaineering diplomacy. They've been doing it in other countries since before the Iron Curtain fell. And now, well, remember how a general once said Iran could not be attacked because it was too mountainous? Well, American and Iranian hikers climbed some of those mountains together last summer, at a time, in fact, when two American hikers were still being held in an Iranian prison. In a few minutes, we're going to hear from an American journalist who's written about all of this. But first, one of the Iranian climbers, Abbas Sibedian, an Iranian businessman, joins us on the phone. He's been visiting the U.S., planning the next joint climbing trip this summer here in the U.S. And Abbas, first of all, why do you climb these mountains? What's the attraction?
This is a question that so many people ask the climbers. I tell you, maybe a little bit funny, a friend of mine was climbing a mountain, and the villagers there asked him, "Why do you go there?" Said, "For climbing." And then he asked, "Are you paid for that?" I said, "No." And then, "Is there a treasure hidden on top of the mountain? You're going to find it?" I said, "No." The other funny question is maybe that you're going to the top, then you have to come back. Why did you go there? You're already here. And many climbers just answer, because the summit is there, so we have to go there.
Because the summit is there.
Yes.
To get to the top. That's why you do it.
Yeah. For myself, I need to escape from the city sometimes. The pollution from all the stresses that are in big cities like Tehran, and you need to get rid of them, go to the mountains. And adventure is, you need some excitement and a little bit of adrenaline in your blood.
You sound just like climbers anywhere. They need to get out of the city. They need adrenaline in their blood, and it sounds just the same. And so here you have teamed up with Americans to have the climb in the past, another one you're planning. I'm reading a quote from an article that Gregory Crouch, who we're going to speak with, wrote in The Atlantic. He says another climber said to him, "Through the rope, our peoples become closer." What do you get out of the joint climbs with Americans?
Oh, very interesting and very nice. In general, I could say that I found the American people very kind, very, very kind and very friendly. Yes, that's right. What Greg says is quite right. When you are in the rope with someone, you get closer to him or her because your life is in the other person's hand.
We should explain, when we say through the ropes, you guys are actually tied together. If one falls, the other can quickly jam something in the rock and hold everybody or not. And, you know, that calls for a lot of trust.
Yes, there is always some risk when you're on a rope, but yes, you need to trust. And I trusted them, especially this trip. We had a wonderful ice climbing in New Hampshire. We went to Mount Washington.
Oh.
Did you know that? I didn't know that before, that Mount Washington has the worst weather conditions in the world.
We know that.
I myself didn't believe it. A mountain, 2,000 meters, how could it be, could it have the worst weather conditions? And when I was there, I realized that I said, yes, that's correct.
Well, so you climbed Mount Washington here in the States in New Hampshire. You climbed with American climbers here. You're planning another trip here. American climbers have climbed in Iran. As you're doing these things, are you ever thinking, what is all this talk, about the two countries? It sort of seems like it would be kind of weird, while you're climbing with Americans.
I'm not a politician, and we hear so many things on the TV, in the press, but what it is important for me is nature, the mountains, and the people. And I think that these kind of exchanges, these kind of mutual relations could assist the people in the governments. I'm here to get to know the American culture, to get to know the people and the mountains and the nature. And for example, I learned a lot about how American Alpine Club try to run the organization, because we have the same problems, like financial problems, because we are an NGO, a non-profit, non-government organization. So we are always looking for the new sources of money.
And I understand, Abbas, that while you have a love of climbing, you also have a concern about the environment and preserving the environment, and that's a part of why you climb.
We have got the same problems in Iran. We have a big country, and there are so many national parks. We believe that some of them are not protected or not kept as it should be.
Yeah.
So any experience we could gain, we could obtain from these trips, meeting the people, or even while you are climbing up a mountain, when you are in the trail, even the signs on the trail could be educative. For me, it has been a lot of experience that I would like to share it with the other Iranian climbers, because we are very strong about environmental situations and decisions.
Well, Abbas Abedian, again, a member of the Alpine Club of Iran, planning another joint climb with the American Alpine Club. He's done a couple already. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Rabin.
Let's now turn to journalist, author, climber Gregory Crouch. He wrote about these joint climbing expeditions for the Atlantic. He joins us from KQED in San Francisco. Tell us a little bit more about climbing in Iran. We were not eager to talk to Abbas about some of these political things, but we understand that, for instance, the Iranian government was very suspicious about climbing at one point.
Well, as I understand it, leading up to the Islamic Revolution against the Shah, the climbing community in Iran was kind of a hotbed of anti-Shah dissent. So, yeah, it has a history of, being connected to that larger urge for freedom. I think my observation would be that for the Iranian climbers, that distance between what they feel in their normal existence and the sense of freedom that they get in the hills, they're getting more out of it than most of the rest of us.
Okay, let's pick up with that. That's journalist and climber Gregory Crouch, who wrote about U.S.-Iranian mountaineering for the Atlantic. And Greg, we noticed that men and women climb together on this expedition, the women, of course, wearing the headscarves that are required in public. But you wrote that all of the climbers on the trip joked about hiking above the scarf line. What does that mean?
Well, the further away from the road you are, the further that is from sort of direct supervision, and the women would feel less compelled to comply with the regulation than they otherwise would have been.
Well, and you're not a government organization. This is not, State Department run or anything like that. This is, completely a civilian organization. But we understand in Iran, you had to have a climber from the Ministry of Tourism on the trip. It was required. How did that go?
We were all pretty trepidatious about that to begin with. I mean, that is definitely not our experience in the climbing world. However, that fellow, Hossein, he was very reasonable, and he certainly did his best to accommodate us. I think we all made him crazy. Hossein was doing his best in a difficult situation. Herding climbers is like herding cats, his job was essentially to keep us on the program. I mean, he has to report back to his ministry every day that we were where we were and we're doing what we're supposed to. But climbers being climbers have a lot of individual initiative, and we would tend to see something that was off the program and become curious about it and start pestering him to let us see it, which meant that he had to call back to Tehran and get approval from his ministry people, which generally he was able to do. But if it was, say, at 5:01 and the ministry had gone off work, he wasn't able to make that happen until the next day. And of course, we were frustrated by that. And he was frustrated by us being unwilling to stick with the program.
You know, it's interesting. We were talking about, you know, why Iranians climb. And you went to West Point, you know, which is a place of regulations, and you say you discovered climbing at that time, you know, maybe to escape that kind of rigid life. And you saw that Iranians were maybe escaping another kind of rigid life. One said to you, up here, there are no men with long beards and mustaches.
Well, yes, certainly from my experience as a West Pointer, that is a rigid and regimented lifestyle, and climbing to me represented escape from that and, you know, pure freedom where I'm responsible for myself and the consequences of my own actions, and there are no, you know, obligations. I do what seems important to me, and I think that that's very true. I think many of the Iranians that are climbers are responding to those same sort of pressures, what you can and cannot do is pretty closely prescribed in the Islamic Republic. And when you are outside of the cities in the climbing world, you know, you are self-responsible out there. Right. You get to choose. And, you know, the consequences of mistakes in climbing are very severe. So, you know, you have your own responsibility in ways that you don't have when you're so closely supervised.
And as we mentioned, you are bound together, and so you're responsible to each other out there climbing. I mean, I'm seeing some of the things that some of the Iranian climbers said to you. At one point, you've befriended one of the climbers, and the Americans are begging him, please come climb in the U.S., and he says, guys, I've been to Afghanistan, I've been to Pakistan, and I look like Osama bin Laden. I am not getting a visa to the U.S. Now, that's a fun joke, but were there...
That was awesome.
but was there, you know, late at night around the campfire, talk of politics?
Yes, but more in the sense of sort of lusting for more expansive lives and a wider range of opportunities. I really enjoyed all the Iranian people, men and women that I was able to meet and climb with, and I really hope that their lives are able to blossom in that sort of direction. And by the way, in running these exchanges, it was the American government that was making the difficulties in lots of ways. You know, the people that we climbed with are all wonderful folks, and many of them were not able to get visas to come to the United States. And that was the primary organizational difficulty, was this direction, not that direction.
And by the way, we've been talking about, you know, oh, there's climbing in Iran with what we know is a very repressive government. You know, we're not, you know, that is true. But I am wondering, too, if the fact that Iranian climbers are coming to the U.S., you're seeing the U.S. with fresh eyes. Is there something about the U.S. that you are seeing through the eyes of an Iranian?
Yes, I think there were a lot of things that struck them as very odd about our culture, and the sort of lack of supervision is one that I think also impressed them. You know, when I was in Iran at the very end, I remember a fellow asking me, you know, well, what does your Ministry of Sport think about climbing? And I'm like, dude, there is no Ministry of Sport. Nobody's telling us what to do. And if they did, you know, we would not respond well to that. I think I had a much more colorful expression that is certainly not going to be FCC approved, but of what we would tell the Ministry of Sport to do to itself. And he looked at me with like total bafflement for about 10 seconds. And then this huge grin broke across his face and he just sort of sat there nodding for a few seconds in approval.
That's climber and journalist Gregory Crouch talking about joint climbing expeditions with Iranians. He's written about it for The Atlantic. We'll link you at hereandnow.org. And by the way, Gregory is also author of the recently released LA Times bestseller, China's Wings. Greg, we'll have to have you come back and talk about that. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Robin.
Imagine a university with around 30,000 students heading into finals, having to do bag searches and check IDs at many campus buildings. That's what's happening at the University of Pittsburgh, which has been turned upside down by at least 25 bomb threats since February 13th. Students are awakened in the middle of the night for them. Professors are offering classes in their homes. The investigation now involves the FBI and the region's Joint Terrorism Task Force, as well as school and local police. The school is offering a $50,000 reward for information leading to an arrest. Michael McEnony is editor-in-chief of the Pitt News, the daily student newspaper of the University of Pittsburgh. Michael, is it safe to say nerves are on edge?
I would certainly say that nerves are on edge, and for some people the experience has been worse than others. The majority of people who live in the dorms, especially those that have been evacuated in the middle of the night, are underclassmen, freshmen and sophomores. They've also had a lot of classes canceled, things like this, that has certainly made their experience more stressful than others.
Are students afraid?
I would say that students are definitely afraid. There's been a lot of talk on campus as to what's going on, what police know, what they don't know. And, yeah, there's definitely a sense of fear. There's a sense of uncertainty, but it's not overpowering in any way. These are threats, and there really hasn't been any indication yet that there's going to be any actual violence or anything like that.
Well, we understand that kids are angry, too. I mean, do you have any idea who's doing this?
There really hasn't been any indication as to who's doing it. A number of weeks ago, a university spokesman said that they had a person of interest in the investigation. There hasn't been any more information than that. It's been 25 bomb threats, but 57 different evacuations because a number of buildings are threatened at the same time. And there's been no statement from police or anything like that that all of these are connected. Some of them, they've said, are, but not all of them.
As we said, the Joint Terrorism Task Force of the region has gotten involved. Behavioral science experts are involved. It's a high priority for the FBI's office in Pittsburgh. A special agent there says that the cybercrime unit that's tracking some of these threats has seen that they include emails bounced off servers in other countries. Have you heard that? What do you make of that?
The Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, I believe it was last week, reported that the person sending these threats actually sent them to some reporters at the newspaper, was using a service called Mixmaster that was able to mask where the emails were coming from. These emails are very hard to track.
Well, then we should say, having said that some of them now are being bounced off servers in other countries, this is a huge change from how they first started. Weren't they just written on walls?
Yeah, they were written on the walls of bathroom stalls in two different academic buildings. They were written on a women's restroom stall wall in Chevron, which is a science building, and the men's restroom stalls in the Cathedral of Learning, which is the largest academic building on campus, houses a huge number of different academic departments, number of different classes every day, and tours of prospective students go through that building.
We understand parents are worried, and they're tracking this on the Facebook page, but is there any sense that the spring term won't be completed?
Well, there's been an official announcement from Pitt that they do intend to complete the spring term. There's been a number of announcements for both students and professors that they intend on continuing the term, and they're setting up alternate methods of completing exams, completing schoolwork, so that things can actually get done. There hasn't been any announcements yet as to what the university's plans are for how to handle finals week or, for that matter, graduation.
And do you worry about going ahead? High schoolers are picking their schools now. Do you worry that this is going to tarnish Pitt?
Well, there hasn't been any indication as to that. I will say that now with new security, the tours that typically go through a number of campus buildings actually aren't allowed to go in there, because a lot of these are prospective students who don't belong to the university yet, don't have IDs, and thus cannot get in.
Oh, boy, so that's hampered that. Michael McEnony, editor-in-chief of the Pitt News, the daily student newspaper at the University of Pittsburgh, which has been shaken by over 25 bomb threats in the last month or so. Michael, thanks so much.
Thank you.
One Nation in celebration, April 2021-22. The 2012 Formula One Gulf Air Bahrain Grand Prix.
That's a promotional video for the upcoming Grand Prix Formula One race scheduled for next week in Bahrain. But Bahrain is a divided nation, and at least one former driver, Damon Hill, says it would be a bad idea for the sport to be seen as supporting martial law in order to hold a race. Bahrain is still in the throes of its failed Arab Spring uprising. Yesterday, at least 7 Bahraini police were injured by an explosion. On Friday, police fired tear gas and stun grenades at thousands of protesters who were marching in support of Abdul Hadi Al-Khawaja. He's the co-founder of the Bahrain Center for Human Rights, jailed after last year's Arab Spring protests and now more than 60 days into a hunger strike that's become a rallying point for the Shiite-led uprising against the Sunni monarchy in Bahrain. Mary Lawler is the director of Frontline Defenders. They're an Irish group that helps protect human rights activists. They're actively campaigning for Khawaja's release. And Mary, you were recently in Bahrain. What's the latest on Abdul Hadi's condition?
I've spoken to medical consultants. He's lost over 25% of his body weight. And apparently, once this happens, there is a risk of organ failure at any time.
Well, we get different reports. The Bahraini officials say they're taking care of him, as you said, in the hospital. The family saying that he's far worse off than they're letting on. What's his importance to the people of Bahrain, and which people is he a symbol for?
Well, Abdul Hadi worked with us for 3 years as protection coordinator for the Middle East. So we got to know him very well. And if you got to know Abdul Hadi, you would see what a strong, charismatic character he is. And he resigned to go back to Bahrain in order to become part of the movement for democracy and human rights. At the time, you know, there was Egypt and Tunisia, and the Bahrainis wanted an end to discrimination against the Shiites there. So Abdul Hadi became a rallying point and a leader among that community. Sadly, he was arrested and brutally tortured, as documented in the Independent Commission report, which was ordered by King Hamad, and the findings have been accepted by King Hamad as well. He then had an unfair trial before a military court and was given a life sentence, which was upheld on appeal last September.
So let's get some context here. We mentioned that Bahrain's uprising was a Shia majority rising up against a Sunni ruling minority. The U.S. eventually supported the uprising in Egypt, in Libya, but not in Bahrain. In fact, the BBC concludes that President Obama might have given Bahrainis the impression he was going to back them when he abandoned Mubarak in Egypt. But the U.S. has stayed away from the conflict in Bahrain. Saudi Arabia, which is also led by a Sunni monarchy, sent 1,000 troops into Bahrain to help quell the uprising there. Just remind us of some of the geopolitical considerations in this region.
The Bahrain is a strategic partner for the U.S. because the U.S.'s naval fleet is based there. So obviously, it's a very important country for the U.S. Similarly, for Saudi Arabia, they look at Bahrain in horror, wondering whether or not that kind of drive for constitutional reform could spread to Saudi Arabia. So they also are interested in maintaining the ruling family there. So it's a difficult position for the Bahrainis to be in. But the problem is, like, the majority have been discriminated against for a very long time. And I suppose, like everything, you know, if you've been discriminated against for long enough and you see what's happening in the region, I think they felt, too, that they could make some progress.
Well, there's another concern. As we mentioned, this is a Sunni ruling monarchy ruling over a Shia majority. Right across the Persian Gulf is Iran, and the Bahraini government, the Saudi authorities, and even U.S. officials have said that they worry that Tehran is helping orchestrate this unrest. Tehran, of course, also a Shia country. So the concern is that Tehran is orchestrating the Shia unrest across the waters in Bahrain. And some U.S. officials have said, you know, on and off the record, that toppling the Sunni monarchy in Bahrain would be a victory for Iran.
from everything I can see, like, for example, with Abdul Hadi al-Khawaja, whom we know to be a human rights defender and whose background has shown that, and he's internationally renowned. So, you know, when the Bahraini government say, as they have in one of them, the prime minister, who is the hardliner, that he's an Iranian spy, it's absolutely ridiculous. You know, nobody believes it. So there is acceptance that there is a need for reform in Bahrain, to give more of a constitutional sort of reform, not necessarily the toppling of the monarchy, but a reform where people have more of a say.
Well, meanwhile, Abdul Hadi al-Khawaja is on day 62 of a hunger strike. We have this Formula One Grand Prix race scheduled in Bahrain for next week. What do you think happens if, I mean, you know, he passes?
Well, this is the awful thing. I mean, he at the moment, nobody has seen him for 2 days, neither his family nor his lawyer. But if he were to die in the run-up to Formula One, there would be huge unrest, I think, in Bahrain. Having been there last week, I could see already the way that the situation is developing. I saw a protest, you know, in favour of releasing Abdul Hadi. There were huge amount of police compared to the number of protesters. A lot of the protesters couldn't actually get outside the Ministry of the Interior where the protest was being held, because that's where Abdul Hadi was at that time. The situation is not safe for Bahrainis. So Formula One really needs to consult with the people on the ground, the independent journalists, the human rights defenders and the community leaders, and come to a conclusion. But meanwhile, our view is that they should use the fact that the Bahraini authorities really want Formula One to go ahead to make a plea that Abdul Hadi would be released on humanitarian grounds to go for medical treatment to Denmark, that King Ahmad would exercise mercy. And that would at least stabilise a bit of the situation.
Mary Lawler, Director of Frontline Defenders, the Irish group that helps protect human rights activists. Speaking of Abdul Hadi al-Khawaja, the Bahraini human rights activist who's in day 62 of a hunger strike ahead of next week's scheduled Grand Prix Formula One race in Bahrain. Mary, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Quick note as we go to break. Have you seen the now famous photograph of Secretary of State Hillary Clinton texting? Well, she's likely deep in sticky diplomatic situations like the one we just talked about. But inspired by that photo, two PR workers created the website Texts from Hillary asking, what do you think she's texting? Here's a suggested exchange with The Daily Show's Jon Stewart.
Daily Show this week?
Already booked Colbert.
Another with Colin Powell.
You're not coming to my party? It's my birthday.
Yo, Colin, I'm really happy for you, but I am one of the best secretaries of state of all time.
And a favorite with actor Ryan Gosling.
Hey, girl.
It's Madam Secretary.
Send your thoughts to hearenow.org. May we recommend a read? It's all storm-tossed New England coast and sailing and rumpled khaki-clad prep school students and loss. Amber Dermont's debut novel, The Starboard Sea, is set before and during the stock market crash of 1987. Its narrator is Jason Prosper, who grew up in a wealthy Manhattan penthouse, complete with preoccupied parents. He's not a bad kid, but seems to attract misfortune. He's been kicked out of prep school and is headed to Bellingham Academy, a refuge for rich kids.
Bellingham offered a sanctuary, minimal regulations, and a valuable lesson. Breaking rules could lead to more freedom. Because the school catered to thieves, sluts, and dope fiends, it was understood that additional transgressions would be overlooked. If you could pay, you could stay. I comforted myself knowing that I'd lowered all future expectations. So long as I didn't torch my dormitory or poison my hallmates, I was free to take full advantage of the lax standards and leniency. But all this freedom would indeed cost me something, a stain on my reputation. I'd been Bellinghammed.
author Amber Dermont reading from The Starboard Sea. Jason arrives at Bellingham haunted by the suicide of his best friend and sailing buddy, Cal. At Bellingham, he meets a young girl with her own troubled past. What follows is a sobering account of the children of the 1%, as well as a love letter to the sea. It's been getting critical raves, and Amber Dermont joins us from Georgia Public Radio. Welcome and congratulations.
Thank you so much, Robin.
Well, and who are these people? Do you know these people?
I do. I do know them. I went to prep school on the coast of Massachusetts. I was a very serious teenager. I actually wasn't like the sort of wild child that I write about, but I was always friends with students like that, and I was always fascinated by their sense of imagination and the misadventures that they were able to create for themselves.
And do you think this reflects, I mean, the way you've set it up, Bellingham is sort of the school that you get sent to when you get kicked out of the others. Or are these characters that you write about really more representative of prep schools?
I think that, you know, in order to sort of shine a light on it, I probably had to take it to an extreme. There are all sorts of wild and unbelievable things that do happen in these spaces, because there's really, you know, once a parent gives their child over to an institution, there's very little that you can really do to punish them other than removing them from that institution. You know, I taught one summer at this pre-college program for very wealthy, very privileged kids. And when a group of them got into trouble, you know, we sent them home to their lofts in Soho and their apartments in the Upper East Side. And it didn't really seem like much of a punishment. So you have this unchecked privilege. And if you can, you know, kind of buy your way out of any problem, you don't really actually have a problem then. And one of the difficulties about, I mean, like when you're an adolescent, you're trying to figure out who you are. And, you know, the sort of funny thing about rich kids is that they know who they are. They're rich. And so the only way you can really define yourself is in opposition to your wealth. And that's, I think, often why you see a lot of, children of very privileged families self-destruct. It's an attempt to self-define, I think.
Well, it's almost as if, gee, what can we... what risk can we take that our parent won't save us from? And they go so far, you know, that it's frightening. Even just some of the pranking. I mean, I couldn't breathe at one point reading about kids who rolled up other kids in rugs and taped them up and left them out on the football field. I had a hard time breathing, you know, reading that. And then, you know, along with that prankster thing, the sort of snapping of towels aspect of it, the sexuality, you know, young men thrown together, young women thrown together, trying to figure out how they feel, you know, towards the young men if they're young men and towards the young women if they're young men. I mean, talk about some of that.
Sure. Well, once I figured out that, you know, my main character was a sailor and that his best friend had sailing partner had died. I imagined the two of them and their bodies together. And if you're sailing on these little dinghies, I mean, you really have to be as intimate as two lovers. You have to move your bodies in unison. And I just kept wondering, like, well, what would happen, you know, once they got back on land? And if you think about athletics, you're taught to, you know, simultaneously work together your bodies in unison on these teams with people of the same gender, and also to fight people of the same gender. So it's sending this kind of mixed message of, like, the first sort of occasion you have for real physical intimacy usually is through athletics, and you're sort of simultaneously being told to engage and then repel.
And these are bodies that are aflame, you know, with yes. with youth. But to stay with sailing for a second, because you do describe this ballet that's often homoerotic, you know, between Jason and Cal, his former best friend. But just sailing in general, you must sail, you know, the detail that you have here.
I grew up on the water. I grew up in Massachusetts, right at the very beginning of Cape Cod. Mm-hmm. And I think it's the most miraculous thing in the world to be able to, you know, go out into the wilds of the ocean and actually, you know, tame it in some way, and to harness the wind. And the language around sailing is very beautiful, all the nomenclature and the way that sailing influences our language. I mean, there's this one section in the book where I sort of have Cal and Jason riff off of all of the common, you know, parlance, all these sayings that it wouldn't occur to you were sailing terms, but are.
Like what? And, like what? That's a fun section.
Give a wide berth, taken aback, above board, true blue, hand over fist, know the ropes, three sheets to the wind. You know, those are all sailing terms.
The other thing that's going on is fascinating as well. As we mentioned, this is in the 80s. And I remember doing some math and thinking, oh, wait a minute. You know, we see some of their parents' fortunes collapse because this is 1987, 88, when there's a big financial collapse. But also, they're going to be the ones who would, you know, if they go to Wall Street, as they all say they're going to, they'd, you know, be part of creating the next financial collapse.
Yes. And that was, you know, it's funny sometimes. In order to write about the present, you have to write about the past. And the thing that I you know, sort of was left with was this knowledge that these teenagers in 1987 are the adults who are expected to sort of reform and fix the current economic crisis. And of course, you know, considering what they grew up in, you know, are they the best people to do that? There's that question that I think sort of lingers, hovers over the book.
Yeah. The title, The Starboard Sea.
I wanted the title to be something that didn't exist already. I wanted it to be a nautical term that either Cal or Jason made up. And so when Cal and Jason are playing their game about, you know, sort of all the different nautical phrases, Cal decides to make one up for himself. And he says, you know, how about the starboard sea? And initially, Jason's like, you know, what, starboard just means the right side, you know, of the boat. Like, what, that doesn't mean anything, you know. And Cal says, no, it means the right sea, the true sea, or like finding the best path in life. I mean, he's sort of pretend, he's like, look, I'm really deep, you know, and sort of kind of joking around about it. But I think that it's the heart of the novel in some way that sometimes you find that. Sometimes you actually find what it is you're meant to do and who it is you're meant to be with. And your life there's order made out of the chaos of your life. And not all of these characters find their starboard sea.
No. Amber Dermott's new novel is The Starboard Sea. Thank you so much for talking to us about it.
Thank you, Robin.